talk this evening is Geology Before Darwin. But it's got a long subtitle to it, The Struggle to Find and Defend the Truth About the Earth's Past. David's basically going to be telling us about what was going on in the years coming up to Darwin's Origin of Species publication in 1859, and what was the golden age of geology in the sense that everything was being put together finally to make sense of it at that time. Dave Bosser did his doctorate at Dartmouth in mathematics, but had been a physics training up until that point, and has been in the area of systems analysis, right? For many, many years, working with government contracts of one sort or another. Somehow he ran into our seminary, I think evening school class or something, and decided to take the whole program. So he has Master's Divinity here from Biblical. He and his family have been living up in the Lebanon, New Hampshire area now for a number of years. And Dave is retired, so he's doing all the things he wanted to do and never had time to do. So we're going to look at one of those this evening. David.
Thank you, Bob. I must confess that I was at first startled and alarmed by rumors of changes and discoveries which, I was told, were to overturn at once the science of geology as hitherto received, and all the evidences which had been drawn from it in favor of revealed religion. Though well persuaded that at all times, and by the most unexpected methods, the Most High is able to assert himself, the proneness of man to make use of every unoccupied position in order to maintain his independence of his Maker seemed about to gain new vigor by acquiring a fresh vantage ground. The old cry of the eternity of matter and all things remain as they were from the beginning until now rung in my ears. God with us and the world of science henceforth to be no more. The very evidences of his being seemed about to be removed into a more distant and dimmer region, and a dreary swamp of infidelity spread onward and backward throughout the past eternity. This quote, which comes from the preface to Hugh Miller's Sketchbook of Popular Geology, which was published in 1859, sets the scene for our discussion. The statement comes from just 10 years after it was first published in 1854, and I'm quoting from the fourth edition, which was in 1869, pardon me. It sets the scene for our discussion. The statement comes just 10 years after the appearance of Darwin's Origin of Species in 1859. Already in that short time, the mood of geology had shifted dramatically from a wide consensus that noted strong evidence for God's handiwork in creation to a naturalistic view that saw no need for God. As Lydia Miller wrote, God with us to be no more. The dreary swamp of infidelity seemed to flood the landscape so soon after many prominent scientists had declared that the evidence of geology strongly points to the work of a creator. Lydia expressed the consternation that must have been shared by many of these geologists. Had the new changes and discoveries indeed so altered the landscape? What had they missed in their so careful analysis of geological data? Done, by the way, amidst hostile opposition from all sides, and thus carefully crafted, or so they thought. In the end, Lydia remarked that, no, they had not missed the mark. The evidence is still the same. It has not changed. It's only been ignored and brushed away. So with these words, we have our task set before us, to look at what these early geologists found, or thought they found, assess it, and then ask, with Lydia Miller, is the evidence in favor of revealed religion still the same? Is it still valid? And is it being brushed away to a more distant and dimmer region? To begin with, I'd like to say something about how I became interested in 19th century geology. I finished a series of 7 talks on What is Life a year ago this month, and the next logical step was to try to put the series into book form. The series ends with some comments about geology, and in my reading, I repeatedly came across references to Sir Charles Lyell, a prominent geologist in the mid-1800s. So I looked at his 2 principal works, The Principles and Elements of Geology, published in many editions between 1832 and the 1860s. As I read, I marveled at the very positive way that the essential role of a creator figured in his treatment. It was presented as a very natural conclusion of the objective findings of geology. it caused me to wonder whether this recognition was peculiar to Lyell, or whether it was pervasive throughout geology at this time. And so I read a number of other prominent geology books by other geologists of the period. Many had a similar theme, that the geological evidence points to a necessary role for divine providence. Some were more outspoken about this, some of whom wrote entire books on natural theology, but all were written in a way that at least left ample room for, and indeed argued, the necessity of God in the creation process. This positive theme about the role of a creator sounded strange. Since I had become accustomed to the naturalistic bent that is common in such treatments today, and it roused my curiosity, what had happened to geology between then and now? Was the presumed creator's role just a gratuitous addition to these old texts, perhaps a sop to the religious influences which at that time still held sway in academia? Or was it a scientifically based conclusion? The change, as we remarked, came with the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species in 1859. After its appearance and the fervent promotion by such spokesmen as Thomas Huxley and Ernst Haeckel, adding to the voices of some earlier proponents as Lamarck and Voltaire, a purely naturalistic development of geology, leaving out any mention or admission of a creator, became the required standard for our scientific understanding of geology. So this talk begins with a quick review of the state of 19th century geology up to the time of Darwin, and some of the findings that spoke in favor of a creator. Then we will try to understand what happened after the appearance of Origins. The first half of the 19th century was the golden age of geology. Much of the modern terminology and the outline of geological history of the Earth was laid out at that time. I think it's hard, looking at things from a modern perspective, to appreciate how unexpected it was that the Earth would preserve in its own rocks a vast and minutely detailed record of its own past. Speculation about origins was thought to be the province of philosophers and theologians, not scientists. In 1802, William Paley published his famous work, Natural Theology, in which he used details of nature, and particularly of human anatomy, to show, quote, the necessity of an intelligent designing mind, unquote, in creation. His book apparently caused quite a commotion, both positive and negative, and still excites comment 200 years after its appearance. The book was written just before the science of geology began to take off. And the irony is that the very first sentence in Paley's book shows how completely ignorant he and most scientists of the time were of the vast store of information contained in the Earth's rocks. He began chapter 1, first sentence of his Natural Theology. Quote, in crossing a heath, suppose I pitch my foot against a stone, and were asked how the stone came to be there. I might possibly answer that for all I knew. It had lain there forever, nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer. But suppose I had found a watch upon the ground. 30 years later, William Buckland, an early geologist, quoted Paley's remark, followed by, nay, says the geologist, and then goes on to tell how what that stone may tell us, as detailed and intricate a tale as the one told by Paley's watch. Important preliminary steps had taken place about 50 years earlier, around the 1750s, by Buffon and Linnaeus. Linnaeus's great work on the systematic description of plants and animals, Systema Naturae, was published in many editions. He worked on this throughout his life. The 10th edition, published in 1758, established the practice still followed today of naming a species by two Latin names, the genus with an initial capital, followed by the species, for example, Homo sapiens. He firmly believed that species could vary only within certain limits. At the same time, his contemporary, Buffon, worked on the 44-volume Historia Naturae, a vast attempt to catalog and describe all of nature. These early efforts to study nature systematically provided an essential basis for the later systematic development of geology. In a sense, geology could not have proceeded without the work of these great men. Modern geology began in 1799, some decades after the work of Buffon and Linnaeus appeared. In this year, it was first publicly recognized that the rocks preserve a detailed record of the Earth's ancient history, one that is consistent worldwide. The sheer extent and detail of the story told by the rocks was a total surprise to the scholars of the day and remains a surprise even today. Not that they lacked notions about the Earth's past in those days. Puffin's work included much along these lines. But these notions were mostly based on philosophical considerations rather than on systematic objective science. No scientist or philosopher was prepared for the sheer volume of significant information that these rocks would tell. An example, in my view, of the silent voice of Psalm 19, declaring God's glory. There's a little story about this beginning, which can be named down to the specific day. William Smith was a self-educated engineer who worked in the quarries, mines, and canals of Wales and England. In his work, he became intimately acquainted with the many strata of rock that exist on the Earth's surface and came to realize over some years that the strata are consistent all over England, that they are uniquely identifiable by the type of rock and the fossils that they contain, and that strata are laid down in an orderly sequence from the very earliest fossil-free strata to the most recent strata. He recognized that the strata of England and Wales tilt uniformly to the southeast at about a 3-degree angle of tilt, so that rock outcroppings generally become older, that is, lower in the sequence, as one goes from the vicinity of London in the southeast to and on through Wales and Scotland. Wales is to the west and Scotland to the north. The oldest fossil-bearing formations in northwest Wales and Scotland are from the Cambrian era, the oldest of the fossil-bearing rocks, and the youngest in southeastern England are from the Triassic period, shortly after the age of dinosaurs. The KT boundary, which marked the end of the dinosaur age, is a line oriented in the northeasterly direction that passes about 20 miles northwest of London. This map, I changed the colors from what was originally on them, so that the darker the color, the older the rock. So you can just glaze your eyes here and see the darker colors of the older rocks, and then they get lighter as you come southeast. There's a story that William Smith visited two fossil collector acquaintances, Benjamin Richardson and Joseph Townsend, on June 11, 1799. And during their conversation, William Smith stated that he could give the particular stratum where the collector's fossils had been found, and also could predict what fossils would be found at any given location on the horizon about the collector's home. They then trooped out into the surrounding countryside, and the accuracy of his assertions were so astounding that the collector urged him to list and identify the rock strata in their proper order. With William Smith dictating and Joseph Townsend transcribing, the world's first orderly list of 23 separate strata with their thickness, identifying characteristics, and characteristic fossils was set down on paper. After the class, we're going to have a quiz on list these in order, okay? I can't read it either. That was the best copy I could get, and it was at low enough resolution I couldn't even read the words. I guess you can read some words if you read very carefully. Following the publication of this list, the same strata, occurring in the same order, were identified throughout Europe, North America, and Russia. Many of the modern names for the rock formations are the same ones given to them by William Smith, often rather barbaric names, as he liked to use the names that the miners and the quarrymen used. William Smith's crowning achievement was a 6x8 geological map of England and Wales, based on data collected by himself all over England and Wales and Scotland, and completed in 1816. It still hangs in the Burlington House in London. The key discoveries in William Smith's work, recorded on that birthday of geology, were, first, that most of the rock on land is sedimentary rock, laid down in identifiable layers or strata. Second, that the strata extend over large areas. Third, that the strata are characterized by the type of rock and the fossil species. And fourth, that the strata are laid down in a specific order. The fossils are the key, and that is the peculiar insight of William Smith. Before his insight, fossils were thought to be scattered about more or less by chance. I believe that many knowledgeable people today probably still think that. In fact, I probably thought that 3 or 4 years ago. Georges Cuvier, the outstanding French geologist of the time, pointed out the significance of these fossils in his 1825 book, The Revolutions of the Earth. Quote, "How was it overlooked that it is to fossils alone that must be attributed the birth of the theory of the earth, that without them we could never have surmised that there were successive epochs in the formation of the globe and a series of different operations. Indeed, they alone prove that the globe has not always had the same crust, by the certainty of the fact that they must have existed at the surface before they were buried in the depths where they now are found. If there were only formations without fossils, no one could prove that these formations were not simultaneously produced. Without fossils," Cuvier continues, "the science of geology would never have begun." He makes these further points. Fossils tell us that many of the sedimentary rocks were deposited in situ underwater, not madly churned or rushing water, but tranquil water, quiet water. Fossils tell us that the nature of the water and the environment changed from time to time. Salt water, brackish water, fresh water, deep water, shallow water, tropical, temperate, or frigid water. Fossils tell us that these submerged sediments were subsequently exposed on dry land. Fossils tell us that the land was alternately submerged and exposed multiple times. The publication of William Smith's findings led to a concentrated effort to interpret the geological record. Major efforts to catalog the geological formations arose worldwide over the next decades. One of the most astonishing of these is the project to record the natural history of New York, which was carried out over 50 years between 1843 and 1894 and directed by a single person, James Hall, over that entire period. The situation, after William Smith's discovery in 1799, was something like walking into a Mayan temple with hieroglyphics on the walls. Realizing that the hieroglyphics were more than just pictures, they were clearly saying something, and then puzzling out what they say. William Smith showed that the rock strata say something. They exist in an orderly sequence. They are identifiable mineral composition and contain unique fossils. The question is, what do they say? The speech is there, but what does it say? The answer to this question is the essence of geology as it developed by the mid-1800s. To begin with, the following general facts were already well known by the early 1800s. First, that much of the rock of the world exists in strata, which appear as if they were formed from sediment layer upon layer. Some strata are thousands of feet thick. The sum of all the strata amounts to tens of thousands of feet of sediment. The strata occur in an orderly sequence that persists worldwide, as far as it could be checked at the time. Many strata, tens of thousands of feet thick in some places, show that they were deposited under tranquil conditions, thousands of thin layers laid in succession, sometimes showing evidence of tranquility such as wave ripples or the impressions of animal footprints. Secondly, that almost everywhere, even on high mountains, are extensive fossils of seashells and other marine animals that imply that virtually all the land was once underwater. In some localities, alternating strata exhibit marine and land fossils indicating multiple long-lasting periods of inundation and exposure. For example, the Paris Basin, which was the specialty of Cuvier. Third, that modern fossils occur only in the uppermost strata, while the lowest strata contain no fossils at all. Each stratum corresponds to a geological age, and the order of the strata progresses from ancient to modern. Every major kind of plant and animal has an identifiable stratum where that kind first appears in the fossil record. Once a kind appears, it's normally present in later strata, but each stratum exhibits unique species. The first appearances display a progression from simpler to more complex plants and animals, culminating with mammals and humans. Hitchcock observes, quote, "The remains of animals and plants found in the earth are not mingled confusedly together, but are found arranged for the most part in as much order as the drawers of a well-regulated cabinet. In general, they appear to have lived or died on or near the spots where they are now found." Fourth, that the rugged landscape seems to imply a past time of violent land movements. These facts can hardly be disputed by a person who has studied the evidence. The question is, What do you conclude from them? One of Lyell's major achievements concerned the last point. In a word, the implication of an extraordinarily violent past is wrong, or at least misleading. He devoted a major part of his first book on the principles of geology to defend a uniformitarian view that the same laws of chemistry and physics prevailed in the past as they do at present, and therefore that the Earth's past can be fully understood by examining the present. There is no need to postulate special conditions or novel laws to explain what we observe in the geological record. He asserts, quote, "We come to no spot in the history of the rocks in which a system different from that which now prevails appears to have existed." A necessary implication of Lyell's uniformitarian argument is that the rugged landscape formed over many thousands or millions of years. The uniformitarian principle is also fundamental to modern research into, for example, the behavior of the very early universe, as early as fractions of a second after the Big Bang. The laws of nuclear physics and chemistry are the same, if they are adjusted to reflect the high heat and density that prevailed at that time. That is why we can use high-energy particle accelerators to learn how particles behaved at those early moments. Lyell gave convincing proof that the lifting of the land and the upheavals that produced the mountains occurred over very long periods of time, and came about so gradually that they did not substantially disrupt the existing ecosystem. In fact, viewed from the eyes of a contemporary observer, the uplifting might go virtually unnoticed. Lyell noted, for example, a 100-mile length of the coast of Chile rose about 3 feet in a single earthquake, which, while it was violent in spots, did not substantially upset the pace of life as a whole. Lyell concluded, after extensive research, that the rough terrain is the result of vast movements of the Earth's surface, and that these movements were energized by heat deep in the Earth's interior. Once this view was generally accepted, the question arose, where does the heat come from? This proved to be a very hard to answer, and indeed could not have been answered using the laws of physics and chemistry known at that time. The full answer didn't come until over a century later, in the mid-1900s, when the science of nuclear physics matured. It's a remarkable testimony to the dogged adherence of these early geologists to the actual evidence that they persisted in the belief that the Earth's interior was hot, despite the failure of any known science of the day to give a plausible explanation for it. From the very first, as the geologists began to interpret these facts, there was vigorous opposition to their work. The opposition came from all sides, from theologians on the one hand, to naturalists on the other. It seems that everyone had a reason to object to the young science as it was being developed, which led to the very excellent result that the findings were hammered out with great care and thoroughness, and an exceedingly careful distinction was made between the conclusions that could be proved by the evidence and conclusions that were founded primarily on metaphysical assumption. This great care and thoroughness is one of the reasons why the rapid change in viewpoint after Darwin's Origin of Species appeared was so unsettling to Lydia Miller. Are the points of contention the valid findings of objective science? Are the points central to the argument? Are they truly telling blows or just arguable points in the periphery? I will list some of the arguments that seem to me to be the most significant, so you can get an idea of the scope of the matter and remark on some of them as the time allows. Of course, some of these points are discussed at length in the geology books of the time, to which you may wish to go for further information. At one extreme sat the theologians. There were three primary areas of contention. First, the age of the Earth. One early conclusion of the geologists was the Earth was very old. They did not have the tools to put a precise number on the age of the Earth, but it was clear to them the age was at least in the many millions of years. Second, a universal flood. At first blush, the evidence that most of the Earth was once covered with water was seen as proof of Noah's flood, but it was pointed out by scientists as early as Robert Hooke, more than a century earlier, that Noah's flood was both too violent to account for the vast layers laid down under tranquil conditions, and too calm to account for the great dislocations that resulted in the marine fossils existing on high mountains. Third, death prior to Adam. Quote, "Geology distinctly testifies to the occurrence of death among animals long before the existence of men, unquote. That's from Hitchcock. So geology was seen to contradict what were believed by many theologians to be the assertions of Holy Scriptures, that the earth was created very shortly before man, that death came about as a result of Adam's sin, and that there was a global flood. These views are based on the most direct and literal interpretation of the Bible and are still quite popular among many evangelical Christians. It is not surprising that those who accept this interpretation of Genesis would have severe problems with any science that claimed findings that contradict these views. As an aside, it is interesting to note that a number of evangelical scholars of the late 19th and early 20th century accepted these findings of geology. For example, the widely used 1917 edition of the Scofield Bible did, as did a number of conservative Bible scholars of the time, such as Charles Hodge. I grew up in the Scofield Bible. That was a familiar one to me. I don't know if it's as familiar to people today as, or not. At the other extreme from the theologians, opposition came from what are called naturalists, those who believe that the living world came about by purely natural processes and deny the need for a transcendent creator. With apologies to the theologians among you, I would like to pay particular emphasis to this side of the controversy because it goes to the heart of the current arguments about evolution. Life, for the naturalist, developed from non-life by natural means. Advanced life developed from primitive life. All the marvelous features of all living creatures just came about by mindless natural processes without any need for a creator. This naturalistic viewpoint came as a philosophical predisposition, which dates back to the ancient Greeks. In the contemporary context of 19th century geology, the prominent people who argued for naturalism included Voltaire and Lamarck. Clearly, a naturalist must believe that the present system of living species came about by some form of spontaneous generation, and by evolution called progressive development by Lyell and other early geologists. Spontaneous generation was coming under a severe cloud at the time, although Pasteur's definitive experiment did not take place until 1859, the same year as Darwin's Origin of Species appeared. Lamarck was a prominent proponent of progressive development. In opposition to Linnaeus, the issue was posed in the form of a question: is there such a thing as a species? In other words, are there essential limits, as Linnaeus affirmed, that separate various kinds of plants and animals, or is it possible for any kind to be linked to any other kind by purely natural variation? Lamarck argued that species is a useful concept only in the short run. Given enough time, anything can become anything else. Linnaeus argued that there are essential limits that define species and cannot be crossed by natural processes. Lyell, the geologist, stated that the position of Lamarck finds no confirmation in the fossil record. The appearance of new fossil kinds is sudden, and there is no evidence, even in the long geological ages, for a species to develop a major innovation. Lyell remarked that the arguments that Lamarck cited only go to show that certain attributes of a species can be sharpened or diminished over time, but, quote, no positive fact is cited to exemplify the substitution of some entirely new sense, faculty, or organ in the room of some other suppressed as useless. He goes on, quote, it is evident that if some well-authenticated facts could be adduced to establish one complete step in the process of transformation, such as the appearance in individuals descended from a common stock of a sense or organ entirely new, and a complete disappearance of some other enjoyed by their progenitors, time alone might be then be supposed sufficient to bring about any amount of metamorphosis. The gratuitous assumption, therefore, of a point so vital to the theory of transmutation is unpardonable on the part of its advocate. But we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves. What were the findings of 19th century geology that appeared to contradict the positions of the naturalists? Here are some of the points cited in a number of geology books by the 1850s. First, there was a beginning. Among intellectuals of the time, belief that matter and life were part of a non-ending cycle of existence was connected with atheism, notably the pantheism of Spinoza. This belief was thought to be a matter of philosophy. It was a great surprise that geology could defeat the belief as far as it concerned life. Geology revealed that the earth began as a molten mass. One proof of this, among several, is the oblate spheroid shape of the Earth. The poles are flattened, which is characteristic of our rotating molten mass. Obviously, then, the early Earth was not habitable by any sort of life, and so life began a long but not infinite time ago. Quote, all things remain as they were from the beginning till now, unquote, is not possible. It's provably wrong. Obviously, life cannot exist on a molten Earth, so life clearly had a beginning. Furthermore, as fossil evidence accumulated, it became clear that the various kinds of life, phyla, classes, families, also had beginnings, and that these beginnings were spaced out in an orderly sequence through the fossil record. I should note that the early geologists observed that rocks underneath the Cambrian strata had no fossils, and so they set the beginning of life to the commencement of the Cambrian Age. We now know that many of these rocks underlying the Cambrian Age are populated with microscopic fossils, which may even leave quite visible evidence, such as the stromatolites. The stromatolites were not identified for what they are until the early 1900s, I believe. There were some famous scandals with regard to the identification of stromatolites, misidentification of stromatolites in the late 1800s. The fossils known to the early geologists come from what is now known as the Phanerozoic era, that is, the age of visible fossils, which began with the Cambrian Age. This name distinguishes this era from the earlier era when the fossils were microscopic. Perhaps you might call it the Cryptozoic era. We know today that microscopic life existed virtually back to the very first time that the Earth had cooled sufficiently for oceans to condense from the atmosphere, and that these early creatures built up over literally billions of years the oxygen atmosphere and the available nitrogen that are essential for the visible animals to exist. And I went over this to a great extent in my talk called The Fit Place for Life, which is one of the earlier in the What is Life series, about 2 years ago now, I guess. This one fact, that life had a finite beginning, poses the problem of spontaneous generation. Either life was created by a god or gods, or it rose naturally by spontaneous generation. Next point, the Earth as a whole is hostile to life. We live on a thin shell over a hot, inhospitable interior and under a cold, inhospitable cosmos. The actual volume that is habitable is minute. Furthermore, the two great engines for change on Earth, fire and water, are essential to the development of life but are potentially ruinous for life to continue. Quoting Hitchcock, quote, in the mighty intensity of their action in the early times, we can hardly see how there could have been much of security or permanence in the state of the globe. We feel as if the Earth's crust must have been constantly liable to be torn to pieces by volcanic fires or drenched by sweeping deluges. And yet the various economies of life on the globe that have preceded the present have all been seasons of profound repose and uniformity. It must have required infinite wisdom and power so to arrange the agencies of nature that the desolating action of fire and water should take place only at those epochs when everything was in readiness for the ruin of an old economy and the introduction of a new one. The conditions required for life to exist are exceedingly narrow. At the very least, the conditions are bounded between freezing and boiling points of water. But in addition, there must be available nutrients in sufficient quantity, and as the species complexity increases, the specific requirements for life become more and more particular, and the species' grip on life is increasingly tenuous. And yet the Earth has been host for life continuously since the first life appeared. To Hitchcock, this implies that the development of life did not proceed randomly, but was under the control of a divine power. I should note that to anyone who does not accept the truth of God's providentially sustaining the world, the fragility of the ecosystem and its existence amid hostile surroundings can be a cause of great anxiety and leads to extraordinary efforts to attempt to control the ecosystem by human effort. Next point, there is an arrow of development and progression over geological history. The Earth's history shows a gradually increasing capability to sustain progressively more complex forms of organic life. At many stages in this process, the ecosystem at that stage relied on the products of earlier stages, and the living species that appeared for the first time could not have survived at an earlier stage. In particular, modern life could not exist without the preparation of all the earlier stages. The appearance, then, is of deliberate design, with the specific end of human habitation in view. Hitchcock argues, quote, every successive change of importance on the Earth's surface appears to have been an improvement of its condition, adapting it to beings of a higher organization, and to man, last of all, as the most perfect of all. The progression through all these stages is all the more remarkable in view of the very restricted conditions in which life of any sort can be sustained. Even the primitive species of these earlier worlds had to be exquisitely adapted to survive, beginning with the very first living species. Next, all of life shows a unity of design from the very first appearance in the fossil record. The collection of body plans, or phyla, that characterize modern species is unchanged throughout all the Earth's history. All fossil species are recognizably similar in design to modern species. Buckland wrote, quote, it has not been found necessary in discussing the history of fossil plants and animals to constitute a single new class. They all fall naturally into the same great sections as the existing forms. Here, Buckland uses the term class in the technical sense used in biological classification, which divides the animal and plant kingdom into the groupings phyla, class, order, family, genus, and species. For example, mammals and birds form two of the classes of the vertebrates. So Buckland made the remarkable assertion, there are no unfamiliar classes in the record. Among other things, this unity argues against multiple creators and spontaneous generation. Paley, writing in 1802, notes, we never get among such original or totally different modes of existence as to indicate that we are coming into the province of a different creator or under the direction of a different will. In truth, the same order of things attends us wherever we go. The fossil record is characterized by annihilation followed by innovation. Many of the strata have very distinct boundaries at which the nature of the fossils change dramatically with the sudden disappearance of some species followed by the sudden appearance of new kinds. In some cases, the cause is clearly related to the rising or sinking of the land, but in other cases, the change is even more dramatic, as in the Permian extinction and at the end of the dinosaur age called the KT boundary. The record is characterized by sudden innovations, not gradual change. All of the basic body plans appear suddenly in the earliest fossils during the Cambrian age. This fact was noted by Buckland in reference to the earliest fossil-bearing rocks. Major innovations arise suddenly. What is true of the very earliest fossils also holds for major innovations in the plant and animal kingdom. They arise suddenly in the fossil record, with no evident transitional fossils. This results in the well-known gaps. Buckland notes, quote, it appears that the character of fossil fishes does not change insensibly from one formation to another, as in the case of many zoophytes and testacea, nor do the same genera or even the same families pervade successive series of great formations, but their changes take place abruptly at certain definite points in the vertical succession of the strata, like the sudden changes that occur in fossil reptiles and mammalia. The gaps were well recognized by Darwin, but the general thought among the naturalists was the gaps were the result of the incomplete nature of the fossil discoveries. However, the gaps persist to this day, and the number of examples of supposed transitional specimens is infinitesimal in comparison with the number of gaps. There is no fossil evidence of species improving except as appears to be provided for within the limits of the species. Buckland also noted that the first examples of a major innovation in the fossil record are often quite advanced, and the effect of time often appears to lead to a reduction in ability rather than the reverse, as evolution would seem to require. An example is the ammonites, to be mentioned shortly, and the loss of features such as sight and cavefish. Lyell goes even further in that he argues that a species, when it first appears, seems already to have the ability to adapt to circumstances that it will face. Quote, we must suppose that when the author of nature creates an animal or a plant, all the possible circumstances in which its descendants are destined to live are foreseen, and that an organization is conferred upon it which will enable the species to perpetuate itself and survive under all the varying circumstances to which it must inevitably be exposed. Next, the fossil body plans show fitness and harmony in all details. There are no hopeful monsters in the fossil record. If the record were able to be characterized in that way, then it would not have been possible for Cuvier, an early geologist, to infer the function, habitat, and general features of a species from a single bone, limb, or even a single tooth. Buckland states, quote, "We can hardly imagine any stronger proof of the unity of design and harmony of organizations that have ever pervaded all animated nature than we find in the fact established by Cuvier that from the character of a single limb and even a single tooth or bone, the form and proportions of the other bones and the condition of the entire animal may be inferred." In other words, the animal body plans are apt and appropriate for what they are, for where they are. This argues against unguided innovation of body parts. And next, the fossils show exquisite innovations that address intricate design challenges. The early geologists spent a lot of time examining the details of how the fossil species carry on their lives, discovering the evidence of exquisite fitness for the particular environment that those fossils enjoy. Lyell, Buckland, Hitchcock, and others give detailed examples of the amazing engineering contrivances of ancient fossil species, many of which vanished, together with their exquisite adaptations, over the course of time, but preserved in the fossil record. Buckland, in particular, devoted a large part of his time to the ammonites, now extinct, shellfish that used flotation chambers to control their feeding depth. In some instances, the fossil species used engineering contrivances that are more complex than modern species. He stated, quote, "We are almost lost in astonishment at the microscopic attention that has been paid to the welfare of creatures holding so low a place. If there be one thing more surprising than another in the investigation of natural phenomena, it is perhaps the infinite extent and vast importance of things apparently little and insignificant. From the high preservation in which we find the remains of animals and vegetables of the geological formations, both hard and soft body parts, and the exquisite mechanism which appears in many fossil fragments of their organization, we may collect an infinity of arguments to show that the creatures from which all these are derived were constructed with a view to the varying conditions of the surface of the earth and to its gradually increasing capabilities of sustaining more complex forms of organic life," unquote. These, in summary, are some of the findings that the geologists came to by the mid-1800s. Many of the geologists, including Lydia Miller, viewed these findings as powerful testimony for a divine creator. Continued advancement in geology to the present day strengthens a number of these conclusions of the 19th century geologists. For example, regarding the beginning, it is now known that not only life, but matter and the universe itself had beginnings. A thorough understanding of nuclear physics and the nature of radioactivity allows precise dating of the age of the universe, of the sun, the earth, and all the strata of the geological record. Regarding the beginning of life, it is now known that the simplest possible self-sustaining cell requires a genetic code of over 1,750,000 base pairs and over 2,000 genes. How is this to arise spontaneously? It is now understood that the earliest time that life could have existed on Earth is about 3.9 billion years ago, when the Earth's crust first hardened and cooled enough for water to condense into the oceans. And there is indirect evidence of life as early as 3.8 billion years ago, and actual fossils have been found dating to 3.65 billion years ago. These fossils had chlorophyll, light-to-energy conversion, and nitrogen fixing, both very complex processes. This early appearance of life severely limits the time available for it to arise spontaneously. There is no known process that would lead to such complexity of end result by purely random means using the known natural laws of physics and chemistry. Regarding the complexity of the simplest cell, it is known that even the simplest cell relies on exceedingly complex processes that occur on the submicroscopic level, such as the transport systems involving kinesin motor molecules that travel over the cytoskeleton microtubules. It's known that the basic body plans are implemented by an elaborate and delicate control process involving special Hox genes. How are these to be had by random undirected processes? regarding the unity of species. It is now known that all living species use the same genetic coding scheme, with only very minor changes that can be plausibly accounted for by random variation, and follow the same complex central dogma for converting the DNA code to molecules of life. It's difficult to even imagine how the complex central dogma, which itself requires over 150 separate genes involving 150,000 DNA-based pairs, could have arisen by naturalistic means. Furthermore, if life appears by spontaneous generation, why is there only a single example of the central dogma? Why not multiple dogmas corresponding to multiple instances of spontaneous generation? Regarding sudden innovations, the near simultaneous appearance of all animal body plans is now accepted as a fact, and that all the 30-odd phyla of animals had their first appearance in the Cambrian rocks. Some geologists even assert that they all appeared within a geologically very short interval of time, perhaps as little as 5 million years. The body plans arrive in the record without any clear relationship to complexity. For example, trilobites, one of the earliest fossils to appear in the record, comes complete with all the major bodily systems, sensors, compound eyes, antenna, olfactory pits, internal digestive system with a through gut, circulatory system, nervous and muscular systems, an exoskeleton, articulated, and with a pumping heart. Regarding the gaps in the fossil record, the sudden appearance of major innovations is well attested in the fossil record and can no longer be attributed to an incomplete record. Indeed, the fact has been given a name, punctuated equilibrium. The gaps have sharpened, not diminished, and the number of proposed transitional fossils is minuscule in comparison with the number of acknowledged gaps. In summary, the modern evidence only confirms and extends the main findings of the 19th century geologists, and the evidence in favor of naturalism is not strengthened, as far as I know, in even a single point. So what do we make of all this? Is there a powerful evidence in favor of a creator, as many geologists believed prior to the appearance of Darwin's book? Well, these arguments seem powerful to me, and they are only a fraction of the evidence that is offered in the geologists' writings of the time. I have intentionally omitted any remarks along the lines of what I might call fit design arguments, along the lines used in Paley's book, such as arguments that are quite convincing to a person who's already inclined to believe in the reality of a creator, as I am, but don't carry much weight with a dogged agnostic. For example, Buckland and Lyell note that the very ruggedness of the terrain, the high mountains and the exposed upliftings, are examples of God's providence because they are necessary for man's well-being. Lyell's Principles has an extensive discussion of climate and notes that mountains help to control weather patterns, particularly rainfall. Alternations of permeable and impermeable rock strata facilitate the watering of lowlands by, in effect, providing natural aqueducts that channel water from the mountains to the lowlands. In particular, London and Paris benefit from this effect. Buckland argues that the coal buildup during the Carboniferous Age fueled the modern industrial age, and without it, civilization would still be an agrarian society with severe fuel scarcity limiting progress. Without the uplifting of the land and the exposure of the Carboniferous rocks, the coal would have been inaccessible, and its quality is probably not even known. But leaving even these arguments aside, the evidence that we have noted in favor of a creator is very powerful. How can science ignore them? I believe Lydia Miller has it right. Science just doesn't contemplate it, but removes it to a more distant and dimmer region. It's not viewed as proper to admit a creator in science discussions. The evidence, objectively considered, points to a divine creator. This evidence is not philosophical, it's concrete and can be tested. Attempts have been made to disprove its findings for over 150 years without success. Only by removing the evidence to the dimmer regions can it be ignored. The silent voice of geology and the fossil record tells a powerful story in favor of a creator. Thank you.
Time for some discussion here. Anybody got any questions, comments?
Just a comment. I think that was a very nice presentation. Mm-hmm. I was not aware of the degree to which this was debated and discussed in the early geological literature.
Neither was I.
It seems that they had developed, prior to the time of the publication of Origin, a fairly sophisticated and robust analysis of the existing data today, and the state of geological discovery that had been made seems to be quite advanced, more than I would have given it credit for.
I get the feeling that with the origins and the evangelistic pumping of the origins message by Tickell and Charles Huxley, they abandoned the very careful analysis of things that they had characterized the geological development, golden age. Geological golden age developed within a lot of tension. And that tension simply wasn't there among the intellectuals after Darwin, because Darwin gave them the answer they wanted to hear. So the tension disappeared, and everybody went railroading down the evolution line. That's the way I see it. But I, too, was exceedingly surprised at how extensively and carefully. I mean, there are books that spend 200 pages making one of these points and all coming to the conclusion of, well, this has got to be God's providential activity. That's why when I started doing this, I was going to be working on my book, whatever you want to call it. But this was so astounding to me that I had to research, and I spent almost a whole year working on it. Some of the books that I cite are there. I do not have Lyell's books. Lyell's books are very well known, very common. I mean, almost anybody who talks about the history of geology mentions Lyell's principles and elements. They may not mention Lyell's conclusions in favor of a creator, but they mention the books, as they were obviously landmark books in their time. Particularly, Lyell was the person who basically argued with hundreds and hundreds of pages of discussion the uniformitarian view that we can explain all that's around us in geology by assuming the same chemical and physical laws that we have now, because they're, as a matter of fact, one of the authors I cite here, Cuvier, The Revolutions of the Earth, it's one of his books. He was one of the last ones to try to maintain the position that these revolutions are, you know, dramatic changes in the whole economy of science. You know, that before this was happened before. You know, and Lyell, who came, wrote his first book about 7 or 8 years after Cuvier. He tried very hard to defend, you know, he extensively defended the point of view of uniformitarianism, which is that even though they look like they're the result of cataclysmic events, they were cataclysmic events in slow motion, which are so slow that it did not disrupt the economy of the system, of the world in most cases. So that one of the most recent things that I've been pondering about since I have sort of a natural analytic background and desire is, suppose I want to build a place where we can have life, and I start with a molten earth and I start with a sun, and I want to ensure that over a period of 4 billion years the surface temperature of the earth remains within a range of boiling and freezing water, doesn't get out of either range for 4 billion years. Now, I'd be intrigued with trying to build a model that would produce this mass of molten stuff and then have it progress according to the laws of physics and chemistry for 4 billion years, and during that whole time retain an environment on the surface that is congenial to life. I mean, that, you know, just off the top of my head, that sounds incredible. Maybe it is. Maybe somebody could build that model and show that, oh yeah, half the time it'll happen. Or something like that.
Don't forget the heat of fusion and the heat of vaporization is a great big boundary that can't be just tossed around. It doesn't yield to winds and temperature.
Yeah.
You see, things are locked in with two layers. And things aren't going to get very far out of that.
Well, I would love to see someone do a physical model, computer model, and show that, well, that would be expected. I mean, I won't say it. Intuitively, it sounds like 4 billion years to stay within zero, freezing and point and boiling on the surface of the Earth sounds pretty dramatic to me.
Well, even if you've got a designer to put those barriers in there.
Particularly since over that 4 billion years, the sun's radiated heat changed by about 25 or 30%. So you've got to have the radiation of the sun is it going up or down?
It's going up.
Yeah. And so there must be something compensating on the Earth so that it all stays within that very. I mean, that sounds like pretty. Speaking from the viewpoint of engineering specs, that sounds pretty specky. But that just occurred to me as I was going over the talk today. I was thinking, man, I'd love to work on a model like that. Just to see what would come up if you used all the physics laws and the chemical laws, see what's the likelihood that the surface would stay within this range.
I'm going to go look for some beverages. It looks like we're supposed to have some.
Okay. So, I found this study interesting. Yes?
How did the church respond as a whole? I know you touched a little bit on it, but can you in more detail share how the church at that time responded to when evolution came in the forefront, when Darwinism came, and how did the church respond at that time? Was it strong in its stance, or was there problems throughout?
How the church responded to the theory of evolution in particular.
Yeah, and in particular to the talk this evening with all this evidence.
The part of the church that I'm familiar with is the evangelical.
Right.
And they got over the objections to the geological evidence, and they accepted it. And the Schofield did, Hodge did, and I didn't really study a lot of them in that era. But Schofield, to me, had no problem with the findings of geology. You wouldn't believe that if you heard what people say today. You would have thought that, it could never have been accepted. But Schofield, who certainly was not liberal. Now, on the other hand, the liberal scholars, I mean, they could, anything that would, maybe be biased, anything that would discredit the authority of the scripture was just fine with them. So, and they have been trying very hard to discredit scripture, Tübingen School and so forth, for 50, 60, 70 years already, so. They were happy to take evolution. I mean, evolution's fine for them. I'm probably being unfair. I should get a spokesman for that school to defend themselves. But what interested me was that the evangelical scholarship accepted, by and large, at least as far as I could tell, accepted by and large the findings of geology. In other words, they got over these initial negative reactions.
Were the initial negative reactions because the theologians of that time were young Earth, or because they were afraid geology was to argue against the Creator?
I think that if you took a time, you stepped yourself right down in 1800, probably 90% of them would have been young Earth. Because they wouldn't have, but their instinct is to oppose it. But fortunately, perhaps, Lydia Miller's husband, Hugh Miller, was one of the founders of the Scotch Free Church, which was the Scotch Free Church broke off from the Scotch Presbyterians because the Presbyterian Church was controlled by the state, and they wanted to have a free church where the elders, I guess you would say, would pick the minister instead of having the state pick the minister. So Hugh Miller himself, who was Lydia Miller's husband, was active in the Scotch Free Presbyterian Church, and he was also a geologist. Hitchcock, I mentioned Hitchcock, was an American geologist of the in Connecticut in the 18, his stomping times were 1840 to 1860, 70, something like that. I have his dates here in the book somewhere. He was also a theologian, and he was the rector of Mount Holyoke, I think, wasn't it?
Amherst.
Yeah, okay, Amherst. But he was a evangelical minister, and he wrote several books on natural theology. There are others. Lyell himself, the one who wrote The Principles and the Elements, was, I wouldn't call him a strong believer. I mean, he was, in fact, some people complained that he soft-pedaled the evidence too much. But there were some good, strong theologians among the early geologists.
You made mention of this tension that helped drive some of the science, maybe sharpen the focus.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, maybe Bob can comment too. You know, we were talking about, you know, that we sort of had this emergence of the modern scientific era, maybe beginning with the Copernican Revolution kind of thing, you know, in the late 1500s. You know, and then driving forward for a couple of hundred years where science is taking and shaping political context, everything else is going on. And now you have this wonderful golden age of geology that emerges in the early 1800s. And it seems to have been extremely productive, very ordered. You know, the level of their scientific accomplishments is just amazing.
And the standards of evidence were very high.
Yeah. And you attribute at least a part of this to this tension that was going on. And part of that tension in a positive way would be these debates. And I was just wondering, I mean, this is a separate subject, but I've never done any reading on it, but this whole question of the age of the earth, which must have emerged probably in several contexts, because your assumption here is that the church probably would have embraced the young earth kind of model for lack of any evidence until, you know, the geological evidence began to surface, that many of those who fall in that sort of evangelical camp embraced that evidence and adjusted their views to accommodate, if you will, the scientific evidence into their theological framework and structure.
Yeah.
Yet we have this reemergence in more modern times of a new debate, if you will, on the age of the earth. And now we find that leading, to some extent, to this whole discussion around intelligent design and the idea that there are philosophers and theologians and scientists who are, again, taking a new look at the data, okay? And again, you know, working with this model, it's almost as if we're seeing sort of a deja vu. We're seeing history repeat itself in some sense. As you know, a lot of that movement is calling for a more rigorous evaluation of the evidence on terms that are fair rather than on biased perception. And we see this big conflict.
But yeah, I see that the with Darwin's Origins, the drive to rigor kind of gave way to the philosophical predispositions. Maybe we have a return to the drive for rigor.
Does this tension that exists sometimes between science and church or science and theology perhaps drive excellence?
Oh, sure.
You know, as an engine for excellence, is that when we don't have these debates, when people are complacent, when we're not asking the hard questions, when we're not trying to do science with ultimate questions in mind. You know, and I'm speaking from my perspective as a scientist. I've seen times where good science is done, and I've seen a lot of mediocrity over my 20-some years of doing science. And I have to wonder if it doesn't raise the bar sometimes that we need this kind of dialogue and this tension between ultimate questions and the analysis of what the creation is.
I think the tension is good as long as you're willing to follow the data when they point. But if you refuse to follow the data, then... Incidentally, I haven't done the... There's a two-page appendix, which I would commend anyone to read about the problem of the source of heat energy. I think that is an amazing feature of the geologists, that they were willing to say that, yes, heat was the basis for the engine for change, despite the fact that there was no plausible explanation at the time for how the center of the Earth could remain hot for the length of period that seemed implied. I think that is remarkable. I mean, you take the evidence leads to conclusions, and, well, it doesn't agree with this, but here's the evidence leads to conclusions. You know, it's sort of a dogged adherence to the results of the science.
Yeah, another example of where you're going to hold two ideas in tension until you get tools to resolve
them. Until you get resolved, yeah. And that wasn't resolved until the 1940s or 50s, as a matter of fact. Yes?
What surprised me very much, I'm a biology teacher.
Yes.
Is that pre-Darwin, these geologists are showing the trilus starting in Cambrian rock, clear as a bell, from what you just said.
Yes.
And these books, clear as a bell. And then we have all these trees of the phyla beginning, going up the tree and getting bigger and bigger, starting with one and bigger, which is a total false to the facts of the case. And then we have gold, and then like Valentine and Batterson, just in recent years, the last 20 years, saying, hey, that's not the way, the rocks aren't saying that. The rocks are saying that a disparity of all these different body forms are preceding the diversity. There is no tree. And what you just said tonight is these guys were saying that before Darwin.
In 1840.
What a mind blower that is for me.
Yeah, well.
You know, the Darwin's model basically evaporated the evidence or postulated the absence of evidence to get around that problem, basically.
Yeah. And these men in China currently are saying there is no tree.
That's right.
And this is nothing new under the sun here. Here these early geologists are saying that clearly.
Yeah.
From Cambrian up.
Yeah.
Across the board.
The, when I studied the phyla and so forth, the systematics, I had the impression that, you know, the first thing that showed up were these non-gut things, sponges. And then we had blind gut things, and then we had through gut things, and then not at all. that's the fraud. Well, if you want to call it fraud, that's the fraud of the systematics, because it implies all this nice order, but that has nothing to do with the order that they appeared, or that they are, you know, that actually is evidenced in the fossil record. Nothing to do with it.